Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did American voters learn at the conventions about the two men running for president this year, and do those perceptions correspond to what campaign strategists hope we will think? With 7 weeks to go until the election, Governor Romney and President Obama are now preparing to debate, raising and spending large quantities of money, and using each emerging news story as an opportunity to distinguish themselves from one another. So how is it all working for them and for the still undecided voters trying to figure out which man is better equipped to deal with the challenges that face us at this moment in history? Joining us this hour to provide expert analysis, we have Bob Ray Sanders of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. Guys, welcome back to Think.
Good to be back.
Glad to be here.
So I hate to have to start with this, but the very contentious responses to the violence at the U.S. Embassy in Libya now has spread to Yemen and Egypt and Tunisia. The Romney campaign has alleged that the Obama administration statements have amounted to apologies to those who committed the attacks. First of all, I'd like to hear each of your takes on whether that is an accurate description based on what you know of the comments that have been released.
Well, it appears to me what Romney did first was issue a press statement at 9 a.m. on the, I guess this was Tuesday, at 9 p.m., and said this will be, it's embargoed until 11 p.m. Shortly after that, Hillary Clinton, and that statement Romney issued was responding to our Egyptian embassy's response to protesters in Cairo who were protesting about this film, which we'll talk about, I assume. So that's what Romney was responding to, and he thought it was too weak. And I have to admit, in what I read of it, reminded me a little bit of what Gene Kirkpatrick used to talk about, the Blame America First strategy, you know. And so I thought it was a little wishy-washy. But so what happened was Romney says, release, here's my statement. It's embargoed until 11 p.m. Hillary comes out at 9:40-something and says somebody – people have been killed in Libya. And so Romney then releases his statement. So it's not a comedy, but it's a comedy of errors because Romney's statement was about something other than the situation in Libya.
Yeah.
And that's what he's – so.
And then there's this bizarre volley of tweets back and forth between the Romney campaign and the embassy, which is, you know, something that could only happen in this day and age. What do you think, Bob Ray? What's your initial reaction?
Well, the question of diplomacy has to be the real question. And it seems to me that the Romney group doesn't understand diplomacy. I mean, it's easy to say, and that's what the base wants to hear him say, is that America has to be strong. This president has been weak. But because they had already lost the foreign policy argument weeks before and certainly during the Republican convention, I mean, there was little talk about foreign policy other than talking about Iran and maybe Cuba even, I think, it came up, but certainly not Afghanistan, not the Iraq War, not the military even. And he jumped on it. I think that they felt they had lost the battle almost on foreign policy coming out of the convention. And his people, who have gotten so many things wrong so many times, said, get out front on this. Here's our chance. I mean, there are people out there tearing the American flag, that great symbol of ours, which was being ripped, and we had visual images of it. Jump on that, because they're doing that because our president is weak. I don't think that argument held. It's not holding right now. They're still trying to push it because right now they're trying to compare Obama's reaction to this event or these events to Jimmy Carter's reaction to 1979 in Iran.
Right.
And I would say that old adage, if you're having to explain yourself in politics, you're losing the argument. And so Romney's comments come, you know, He's having to explain his comments, and so he's lost it. And it is one that is, you know, he's getting beat up on, even if what he was originally trying to go after was something different.
But he's not backing off. I mean,
you're right.
And again, I'm sure he's being told that, you know, you backed off of too many things too often, and so don't do it on this. And so he's buckling down as opposed to backing off. And he's not getting the support of the party. He's getting some support of the base. But you don't hear senators, Congress members coming out supporting this position. They're trying to stay united with America.
Right. You had Peggy Noonan criticizing him, John Sununu. You had Matthew Dowd, who was George W. Bush's advisor in 2004, saying, you know, this is a big gaffe. So you're right.
Well, you know, not so much because of who he is, but because of the position he's in. It seems to me that any challenger who has only sort of domestic governance experience is going to be fighting an uphill battle against an incumbent who has at least for 4 years done that sort of work. I wonder, though, during the convention, if the Romney campaign hadn't simply done research and decided Americans weren't thinking about foreign policy right now and figured it was a safe bet to let that slide.
Well, I mean, there were two things happening, and I found this interesting going even into the convention. They wanted to wage the war on economics. I mean, that was going to be their battle. But they always got off of it, and it wasn't people pushing them off message, I don't think. I mean, they went off message several times. And then when it came down to really talking about foreign policy, as I said, I think they have decided that they couldn't win that battle. And so instead of talking about it or trying to come up with messages that would energize the base and perhaps win over some of the undecideds, they decided not to talk about it at all, which I thought was a mistake going in. I mean, particularly since there are people who think, as I know some of my buddies who are Republicans think, that Obama is terrible as an image in terms of foreign policy. But with the bin Laden thing, with stopping a lot of these other threats that have come forth, I mean, Obama is winning an argument that Republicans used to always win regardless.
I'd say it a little differently. I think if the Romney campaign thought that they were going to get to November by contrasting themselves with Obama on foreign policy, they would have done it. But there's just not a whole lot of room there for them to contrast themselves. This may not the Obama base may not like this, but as people keep reporting, I think it's accurate. There isn't a whole lot of difference. There are differences, but there aren't a ton of differences between George W. Bush and Obama on foreign policy. So they're in a really strong Republican critique. You can give a critique, but it isn't real strong. I think at his convention, I think he did what he needed to do. He needed to humanize himself, show he wasn't a robot, that he was a real person, kind of like Al Gore in 2000. And then he needed to continue to drill home the economic vulnerabilities of the Obama administration. And I think he did that.
Yeah. But, Bill, I mean, on foreign policy, I mean, what is his policy? I mean, what would he have done in Libya? I mean, he's criticized the president during the Arab Spring thing. And the president should have done something else. But what? I mean, I haven't heard him explain what he would have done. And he's still not explaining what he would do right now when you say the president's not tough enough. What do you want him to do? Do you want him to just say I'm tough, that America is great? Or do you want him to go bomb somebody? Do you want him to send in these operatives, secret operatives, into Libya and find the people who did it and kill them?
Well, when you're dealing with non-state actors, though, I mean, there's not a lot of easy solutions.
But they're saying that it's an act of war. An act of war by whom? Mm-hmm. We don't know that.
Let's let Bill in here.
Here's the excerpt in today's New York Times about the quote originally out of out of our embassy in Cairo. The embassy of the United States in Cairo condemns the continuing efforts by misguided individuals to hurt the religious feelings of Muslims. I think that is what they were responding to. And this goes back to and clearly we've got to deal with the Terry Joneses, who was the Florida pastor who wanted to burn the Quran, and that sparked violence in the Middle East, you know. You read the statement, there's kind of a wishy-washiness to it. And I think that's what he's responding to in terms of toughness. But to your point, is there a big difference between Romney and Obama on foreign policy? Probably not. Romney wants to get out of Afghanistan in the same more or less time frame that Obama does. But that's not where he's going to win this election. He will win it on economics if he's going to win it. And he needs to keep going back to that.
Well, and right now he can go back. But back to that statement. I heard Hillary Clinton this morning trying once again to explain, you know, basically that, you know, we have crazy people in this country who say crazy things. But in this country, people can be crazy and they can say crazy things. You know, still, that shouldn't be a cause for violence against Americans. Certainly shouldn't result in death. The reality is that I don't hear Republicans really condemning those people who are out there on the fringe because they tried to appeal to them. I mean,
I don't think you can say that Republicans are trying to appeal to Terry Jones in Florida. I mean,
nobody wants him.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about the people on the fringe who use Islam as a target. I mean, right. the whole idea that you have the Rush Limbaughs and all those people talking about, you know, these Islamists.
Right.
And they include everybody in that. I mean, they're not talking about a fringe. We still don't know how many people were involved in that initial Cairo event. I mean, at least I don't. Maybe you do. But we're still talking about a very small group of people who did whatever they did.
But it's not small now as it ripples across North Africa and the Middle East. So, you know, this is happening elsewhere. And no, I don't know how many people appeared to be coming over the wall or whatever they were doing on the footage that I saw there in Egypt.
Who were unarmed, by the way.
But to your point, yes, are there Republicans for whom Islamic extremism is a hot button issue? Yes. Do I think they are dominant in the Republican Party today? No. And I don't think that is really where Romney is going to that's not where he's going to mobilize voters.
Right, but I'm saying that the majority of Republicans don't rebuke those people when they do and say crazy things.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't.
Well, let's. Right. You guys are not going to agree on this. I don't think anytime soon. We've only got an hour, so I want to move on to this. I want to compare and contrast the two conventions in terms of appealing to the base and also trying to reach across and grab those voters who are undecided. How do you think each campaign did this? And we'll start with you, Bob Ray. What did you find that we'll switch things around? What did you find that the Republicans said that might in fact convince people in the middle that they know what they're doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, I go back and agree with Bill. I mean, we do agree on this, that I thought the convention's part of its job was to humanize Romney. Mm-hmm. And I thought it did that. I mean, if that was one of the goals, it achieved that goal. I mean, through Romney's speech, through Romney's own speech.
Even the videos they showed, were really good.
Oh, the videos they showed, even bringing in the religion that we still, many people don't know a lot about, but focusing on the mission part of the religion, the service part of the religion, the helping thy fellow brother and sister part of the religion, I think that came through pretty well, and using other Mormons to do that. So that happened. In terms of trying to reach out to a larger community, if you will, of voters, I think that helped to a degree, perhaps. I mean, for those undecided, for those people who call themselves moderates or whatever, I think they could identify with that. But the truth of the matter is that when you contrast the Republican convention with the Democrat, I mean, just visually, I mean, there's a stark difference. You know, I mean, the Democrats didn't have to try to move up the Puerto Rican delegates and the Guam delegates to the front to get on camera. I mean, it's natural diversity there. All of those issues, all of those interest groups were there, and they built on something that I thought just overwhelmed whatever the Republicans had produced a week before. I thought the Republican convention was a good convention, considering the things they had to deal with, the weather and all that kind of thing, the postponement of a day. But when you compare the two, the Republicans just didn't do it.
I kind of have my Bob Ray hat on now. I kind of agree with Bob Ray. I think they had a good convention. I don't think they had a great convention. And for life of me, I don't know why they aren't more worried about the moderate voters that you're talking about. And I don't think they really appealed to them, spoke to them sufficiently. Not when you have Ted Cruz on there, you know, with giving his speech or Santorum giving his speech. I just don't think that they were there. What they did do was a good job of emphasizing the debt and the big role it will play in whether or not our economy is going to grow. I think that was important, and that probably spoke to some independence.
That debt clock, pretty brilliant idea.
I like it.
We are speaking this hour with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News and Bob Ray Sanders of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram about post-convention presidential campaign strategy. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-933-5372 is the number. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Bob Ray Sanders of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News about post-convention presidential campaign strategy. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. You didn't have too much time there a minute ago, Bill, so put your Bob Ray hat back on or put your Bill hat on. And let's flip this around. What worked for you in terms of the Democratic convention?
Bill Clinton, two words. He is the person who, of all both conventions, I think, was trying to speak to moderate voters. And by that moderate, in this case, I mean socially liberal, kind of fiscally conservative. The irony is this is Bill Clinton who in 96 or whenever said the era of big government is over. He more or less in the speech was trying to give a defense of Obama's larger government, more expansive government. So there's an irony in there. Having said that, I think he just, you know, with the cadence of the Southern preacher, I think he was speaking to those voters out there who may be on the fence. And, you know, as we were joking here a second ago, if I ever run for president, I want that guy nominating me. He was just, you know, he was so good. And he just raised the bar for Obama for the next night. I think he was the one who moved the needle in terms of independence.
Did he raise the bar too high, Bob Ray?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you were expecting from Obama to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I think Obama did fine in terms of just presenting his view one more time. But he didn't have to say that much. Obama didn't, once Bill Clinton had done it. But also the night before, that night built. I mean, every speaker built on the other speaker, and they carried into that hall and out to the larger audience watching on television. They hit almost everything. I mean, they dealt with the women's issues. They dealt with Hispanic issues. They dealt with immigration. They dealt with the war in Afghanistan. They dealt with the troops. They dealt with so many issues, and there was passion. I mean, and that's what was missing, I thought, from the Republican convention the week before. Everybody who spoke, they weren't just reading a script. Everybody who spoke felt what they were talking about, I think. And I didn't sense that at the convention before. But between what they did on that night and then what Bill Clinton and Julian Castro did, Obama, I think, had it easy. All he had to do was go and be coronated.
Well, but I think Chris Christie had plenty of passion in what he was saying about the debt and the deficit and all of that. I think what—
But he wasn't saying much about Romney.
Well, but he's saying, here's what we need to do, and then he fades into Romney. I went back and read Obama's speech in 2004, the famous one where he kind of gives the keynote of speech. He doesn't talk about John Kerry much in there till the very end. You know, it's all about what we need to do and a lot about Obama. And only Kerry at the very, you know, third of it. So wasn't that different from Christie. But here's what I think Bill Clinton was able to do. It wasn't about class warfare. It wasn't about identity politics. We're all in this together. President Obama comes on the next night. And in my opinion, I think he still is about expansionist government and class warfare. And there was a defiance to his tone, as I felt. And it's more or less like, look, I'm not backing down from being the modern day FDR. FDR was a consequential president, but we're in a different era. We're in an era with this debt. And I think he just still is more in the mindset that we need government to go do these things. What I'm disappointed, and then I'll be quiet here, is that we have on one side expansionist government and another side on the far reaches of the Republican Party, not necessarily Romney, you have a minimalist government. What I'm looking for is somebody who's going to be talking about how do we kind of right-size government.
Well, you know, and the other thing, just picking up on where you left off with Bill Clinton, he said things that Obama couldn't say. I mean, when he said that there are people out there in America who hate this president, Obama can say, I know there are people out there who hate me. When he said that, listen, nobody, not me, not any of my predecessors, could have turned this thing around in 4 years. And believe me, that's going to be the theme from now until November, that nobody could have done it. And so what you need is 4 more years of this man who has us on the right track and he's leading us in the right way. And don't believe what all those people said the week before because they were wrong or they were lying. And that's basically what he was saying. I mean, which Obama can say, they're lying on me. Bill Clinton could say it and he was believable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's take a call here from Brett in Louisville. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Chris. Hey, I had a question. I kind of like to look at the issues and put them down on paper and kind of compare one to the other. And I am normally a swing voter, but as I'm writing down these issues, it looks like the Democratic Party have moved into the Republican realm and Republicans have just gone way to the right. So I'm wondering, is the middle just moved or did I change or something? But I'd love to hear your feedback on that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I would say under Bill Clinton, his comments were perhaps more true than not. I mean, Bill Clinton from 94 on was pretty much this new Democrat, centrist Democrat. I don't get that with President Obama as much. I don't think he is far left. I don't think he's socialist and all that sort of thing. I think he's more center left. So I don't see his policy. You know, look at the trade treaties he's done. Essentially, he has introduced, to my knowledge, no new trade treaties. What he's done is got ratified three that George W. Bush had left behind and couldn't get through the Congress. So he really hasn't gone out and tried to speak about the importance of the global economy in the same way that Clinton did. And in fact, I think he's kind of run a economic nationalism, trying to go after Romney on, you know, having these investments in multinational corporations or outsourcing jobs. Well, if you're going to critique outsourcing jobs, what are you going to say about Apple? You know, well, who? So.
Yeah. Well, was it Brett on the phone here? I think certainly the Republicans have moved far, far to the right, not only in Romney, but in candidates that we're seeing for the Senate and Congress and all over the place, really. And they're so far to the right, they can't get back to the middle, let alone past the middle. And I think that's what's really trapping Romney right now. Romney doesn't believe half the things he's saying. I mean, not based on what he said before, not based on other campaigns that he has run. He doesn't believe that. But he had to do that to win the primary. And what you had to do to win the primary, basically sell your soul to this base of the party, I think it's going to lose him the election.
Well, and I agree with Bob Ray here that the Republican Party keeps getting dragged further and further to the right. And it's like the McGovern equivalent of Democrats. You know, they went so far left that they finally just lost the mainstream. So if Republicans lose this election, what I worry about is that the far right will say, look, you know, you had another center-right guy in Romney up there, and look what happened. He lost, just like McCain did. Well, the fact is both McCain and Romney got pulled further to the right, and that's what's driving the Republican Party. And so if Romney loses, the argument the Republican Party needs to have after this election is how far right can you go? I would argue they've gone about as far as they need to, and they need to move back to the center.
And why didn't they have that debate after the last election?
Because they have a mobilized base of voters in the Tea Party who are a response to expansionist government of Obama and the failure to deal with the debt. And so, you know, it's a complicated picture. But those are the people who are being mobilized to go vote Republican today. And they are not the ones who are, these are not your compassionate conservatives of a former governor of ours.
All right, let's tip our hat to Abigail Adams here and remember the ladies. I'm going to ask you two gentlemen to tell me what your response was to the way that each party tried to appeal to the women in its group. And, of course, you have the very different styles of the two first ladies. I think most people agreed each was effective in her own way. But give me your sense of how that all played out.
I thought the Republicans were straining. I mean, they knew that they had to appeal to women because that's where the big gap is in terms of what the polls are showing right now and have shown for a long time. And I mean, I thought, except for the part where Ann Romney said, "I love women." Well, okay, I got it. But I mean, the fact that she felt she had to say that told me that they're really off base with women. And they have some great women speakers there. I mean, and they have a story. Nikki Haley. I mean, they have governors, they have senators, they have people who, I mean, just in terms of elective positions, Republicans have done a pretty good job with women throughout the country. But they don't appeal to some of those base issues that many women care about, including reproductive rights. And I think with the Democrats, on the other hand, women were a natural part of that. I mean, they weren't picked just because they were women. Some were, obviously, who had a special story to tell. But they were there telling their stories, and they were real stories, and they didn't have to fake it. They didn't have to pretend to love women. They do.
Okay. Well,
Bill McKenzie loves women. We'll start with that.
Thank you. Look, my bottom line is I wish we'd have a moratorium on the spouses speaking because, you know, no spouse is going to get up there and critique their husband.
Yeah.
You know, those lives are more interesting than they portray them as. So, but having said that, I think that Ann Romney did a very good job trying to say this is who's my husband is. That was a big part of her speech. Right. I agree. The line about I love women was a little bit too universal. But I think who she was speaking to are those folks who are out there dealing with economic issues. And I'm not saying the Romneys themselves deal with them, but they are trying to speak to those folks. They're not going to speak to them on social issues. Those for whom social issues are bread and butter issues, they've already made their minds up. They've made up a long time ago. So they're speaking there. And I think she did a good job with that. I think she was able to, put a human face on her husband and the Republican Party, and I think that helped. I think Michelle Obama, on the other hand, it was a little bit more of a policy speech, but she too, described her husband in a way that, I've always, even though his politics may not always be mine, I like President Obama, and I think she did a good job of showing that. They've got a great family and all of that, and I think she also tried to speak to how we're trying to help you economically. So it's a tie. I'm getting a little tired of the spousal speeches.
All right, let's talk about I hesitate almost to go into this, except that there are sort of two different foils. Each party put a very strong, up-and-coming Latino speaker on the podium for a really important speech. I'm curious about your responses to Marco Rubio versus Julian Castro.
Well, I had not seen Rubio that many times. I'd seen him on C-SPAN a few times. And I'd heard him on the radio, so I was impressed. I think he needs, like Ted Cruz here, if he gets elected, he needs some experience, and he needs some more time to actually do something. But in terms of presentation, I thought he was pretty good. And I'd say the same thing with Castro. Castro has who's San Antonio's mayor. He has a happy warrior quality to him, and I think that really wears well over time. I would say to him, whether you're running for governor find an office where you have to run something and manage something for a while. He's being built up as his Latino Obama, and I think the problem President Obama has had is he's never run anything until he got to the presidency.
Well, let me go back on that, because to me, and again, it goes back to what authenticity is when you have these speakers who come up. Marco Rubio obviously has done a great job in getting elected down in Florida. Ted Cruz surprised many people here in Texas by just, whipping David Dewhurst. But what you have with the Hispanics in the Republican Party, they're caught between this thing of I've still got to appeal to that base. And in some ways, I can't be true to who I really am. And that's a tough wire to walk. And where you had with Julian Castro, who with his brother, two of my heroes today, they've done amazing things in a very short period of time, and they have an incredible story to tell. And it's a story that speaks to a lot of Hispanics, not just to Mexican Americans, but to many people who've been struggling, who, second generation or whatever, in terms of growing up here. But Julian Castro doesn't just talk education, for example. On the ballot in San Antonio, there's a 1/8 cent sales tax for the city to fund all-day pre-K in San Antonio. He got that. He got the city council and the business community together. They passed that, and it's going to be on the ballot in November. I mean, that's not talking education. That's doing something about it. That's not just being a face. It's being a leader. And I think he proved himself very well during the convention that he's ready to step on a higher stage. I mean, I'm not sure that he's ready to be president of the United States, and I think he would tell you that. But he's certainly going to be one of the great leaders in Texas and in this country moving forward. I just think that's true. I don't say the same thing for Marco Rubio or for Ted Cruz, for that matter. I see them as being there for that vote, that anti-vote against any Democrat who's in office.
You do see Rubio trying to change the dynamic some within the Republican Party.
I agree.
What issues they emphasize. And I would
say they don't listen to him.
No, but this is my view. I think that he does it with a like Castro. He's more of a happy warrior. Cruz just has, there's an angry undercurrent to what he's saying. And I think that Rubio carries it off much better.
I agree.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Chris. First, I just have to say to McKenzie, he is just such a breath of fresh air in the Dallas Morning News so many times. And I'm not a Republican, but I just appreciate his objective point of view, and even though I don't always agree with him.
Thank you.
We feel the same way.
And I agree.
Okay. Well, however, you were talking about the part of the Republican Party that tends to think Obama's a Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. And McKenzie made the point that that's not the big part of the Republican Party. But in Texas, it is. And I know a lot of people all over Texas, and I'll tell you, among the Republicans in Texas, in the rural areas, all the things you can say, like the things Romney has just said, it doesn't turn those people off. It excites them. And they just elected Cruz. And the national party has to have Texas. And if those people didn't turn out, it's looking like the Republicans, if they don't turn out, the Republicans aren't going to dominate Texas much longer. So they have to have those people out.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, I did go to the Republican Party convention in Fort Worth, the Texas Republican Party convention, and the caller is right. There was a nativist tone that went along with a lot of their comments and the responses. And I don't remember the exact scenario, but somebody hinted at Obama being from Kenya or something like that. You know, which is ludicrous.
35% of Republicans still believe it.
But this guy sitting next to me, he's just going nuts over it. And I thought, you know, come on.
Let's take a pause here. We will come back and also look ahead to the debates coming up between both the presidential and vice presidential candidates. My guests this hour are Bob Ray Sanders of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about post-convention presidential campaign strategy with Bob Ray Sanders of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. So I'm not the first person to talk about this, certainly, but I've been really interested. Both parties are talking about the importance of prosperity in America. The Republicans are saying it's a value we've always believed in. The Democrats are saying, oh, we do too. We just want to make sure there's a level playing field. But it seems that in both conventions, many of the major speakers found any example from their personal lives of a time of financial deprivation and really made a big deal of that. For people who really are struggling at this moment to put food on the table, to get the mortgage paid, to pay their kids' tuition, do those kind of speeches from people in $1,000 suits, do those resonate?
I think it depends on who's giving the speech and how effective they are in doing it. I think to some degree they can resonate. But they've been told that they've got to reach out to these people who think you don't care about them anymore, that you can't understand them. We've been told that the people who don't vote because they don't think people identify with them or their vote will ever make a difference. Or no matter who they vote for, they're still going to be in the same condition. So what they're trying to say is it's like the Baptist preachers or these televangelists, you know. Boy, you know, I was so poor, and look what God did for me. And if you just stay with us, I mean, you can have what I have. And I think that's part of the message that's going out there. But, Yeah, I mean, it resonates to a degree. I mean, it's not that everybody was born in the log cabin, as you were suggesting, but yeah, to say that there was struggle, and now we have the debate over whether or not your struggle was greater than my struggle, and whether or not you had help and I didn't, and I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, but you had to depend on government to get where you are.
Right.
I mean, all of those arguments are going to be there for a while.
Well, you know, this has been part of our American narrative for a long time. So at one level, I understand it and I appreciate it. But when I was watching the Democratic convention, where you heard a lot of this, you heard him on both sides, no question. I kept thinking, how would John Kennedy feel if he were the
I wanted the same thing.
Right.
Or Roosevelt.
Right.
I mean, these were people of privilege for sure. You know, right. John Kennedy.
They couldn't pretend that they had struggled.
Right.
Right. But again, you also had these families that were committed to service. And I think that's the difference you see in some of the things now. You see people who've never done anything else for anybody in particular. And I'm not naming names. I'm not talking about Romney for sure. But suddenly, you know, they want power. They want to be in a position to affect other people's lives. And they haven't been affecting people's lives otherwise. With the Kennedys and with others who have assumed high power, they were committed to public service.
But, you know, I using this happy warrior analogy again, I remember Hubert Humphrey kind of had that quality to him. And he was not one who would play the class warfare card. And you aren't going to find anybody much more liberal than Hubert Humphrey. But he was talking, you know, in effect about how we make all boats rise. We want people doing well. And, you know, this is the irony. While we have these rags to riches stories and people focus on their humble roots, lots of Americans, they want their kids to make it. And I'm not here to say, let's go worship money. That's not what I'm talking about. But people want their kids to do well. So you don't want to demonize that.
Right. But there is a feeling down this country, and I think rightly so to a great degree, is that the privileged are getting a lot of help from government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't admit it, but they are getting a lot of help. I mean, there is a playing field that is uneven, and that the poor will always be kept poor because— You know, I mean, Jesus said the poor will be with you always, right. But not because he commanded that. It's just because you want to help them get out of poverty.
And I think you put your finger on why it's hard for people of privilege to make themselves known in these conventions. So you have Ann Romney trying to explain how they kind of understand each other and talked about the ironing board and that they used as their dinner table or something.
You know what I thought was interesting? And to a large degree, my understanding is people really felt like it worked well when Ann Romney talked about her health battles with MS and with breast cancer. I thought that was a risky choice that seems to have paid off for her to highlight the fact that she had been quite ill. You can hear sort of a segment of the population saying, good thing you had insurance. But I think a lot of people felt closer to her after she revealed those things.
Right. I agree. I mean, I thought that was an important moment because, you know, you can say she's rich, but when it comes to health, yeah, you can get health care if you're rich and hopefully. But disease is no respect of person necessarily. I mean, you can have a disease and suddenly you can be in poverty just as quick as anybody else, depending on your the circumstances. So I thought that was an effective moment. The ironing board thing, I didn't get that. I didn't buy that one. But.
Well, I think what this says also that if you're somebody of privilege, you're going to go into politics. You one of two things: you better really have a really great outgoing personality, and you need to know how to engage people, and you need to be very unpretentious.
And when Romney's on the campaign trail talking about college education and the expenses, and his answer is, well, you got to do a better job of shopping for college or borrow some money from your parents.
But then that becomes the talking point. And so we get this dichotomy, you know, although we're going to talk about people who are poor and they need to rise or struggling workers, middle class workers. And then we got, you know, we're going to demonize Romney for being wealthy. And somehow I just think we need to get past this conversation.
All right, let's talk about the upcoming debates. We'll start with the presidents. I mean, you have two men who I think most people would agree they're both quite intelligent. Like them or hate them, the few people feel warm and fuzzy about either individual in terms of sort of style. You know, Obama was acknowledged by Bill Clinton to have sort of a cool demeanor. What kinds of strengths and weaknesses, just in terms of oratorical style, do you think Romney and Obama will bring to their debate?
Well, two things come to mind right away. And I think Romney has been doing a better job of reacting to the camera now. And I think he'll be prepared in terms of look to be ready for the debates. It's really going to be about substance, I think, more than anything else. Those oratorical skills. I think it really will be about substance this time. And Romney can't be vague. He can't be all over the place on a given issue. He's got to be as direct as possible on some of these questions. And you can anticipate what some of those questions are going to be. They've been the ones that have been asked over the last two or three weeks. And I think Obama will be. I think he will be more specific than Romney. And that will be the deciding point on some of these. Now, unless, you know, Romney's people are going to work with him and have him some answers that he hasn't given so far, I think he's going to be at a disadvantage on substance.
Well, but, you know, I read this the other day, and I really hadn't thought about this. Obama has really not had that many debates. He had three against McCain. Those are the only ones. And he had the ones with, you know, the Democrats. But that's been 4 years. And Romney has had however many Republican debates, seem like they're every other day. So there are a lot of these debates. So he's had a lot of practice at this that Obama has not been engaged in. That said, Obama obviously is very intelligent. He's the law professor, instructor, whatever. So he, you know, he would be good in a parliamentary system to get up and defend his government and all that. So I think, you know, they will both do well. But I could see the scenario that going into this, Obama's a little bit off his edge. He hasn't been in that kind of setting this year or for 4 years.
Yeah, and of course, and they're both lawyers. But I mean, I think Obama does what Bill Clinton did at that convention. Yeah, I mean, you hear the argument and you have a response for it. I mean, and just as if you were in a courtroom as opposed to being on a stage running for president, you take it and you dismantle whatever the accuser says. You tear them down with facts, presumably. But you have to come back right away and build a case. And I think that's going to be the plan for him in each one of those debates.
But don't you think, Bob Ray, that Romney can continue to simply mention the job numbers from this month, from last month, the fact that we still have a significant percentage of the adult population in this country unemployed?
Well, and he's going to do that for sure. And again, I think I just heard on my way over here today that unemployment rate went up again this last week. Yes, that's going to be there. But he's got to have a specific. I mean, he says he's going to produce how many million jobs, 12 million or whatever, new jobs over whatever period, over his next term or two terms if he's elected. He still doesn't tell us why, except for taking taxes away from the rich. I mean that's – he's got to have a better answer than that. And I think right now Obama is being able to deal with that question that, okay – I've got some numbers too. Now they're not in the millions. Well, they are when you put them all together, but we've still been employing people, and he still has that thing about Romney and sending jobs overseas.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, I think you're right that there's data out there that Romney can point to, including this week, that real median income is down, and so he can keep driving those figures home, figures like that. Unemployment is not going to change significantly before the end of the election. So, you know, you can keep, in effect, turn that to Obama and say, so how's that going? You know, but to your point, I think Romney is saying we're going to flatten the tax code, we're going to lower rates, and we're going to – and he said we'll do that by 20%. I think that's too much, but, you know, he's going to lower rates, and I think that's not bad. But he's going to pay for that through getting rid of a lot of exemptions. And that's the problem that he faces is, well, what exemptions are you talking about? One answer I heard the other day was give Americans all a certain figure and let them figure out which exemptions they want to take. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, but that's not leadership. Either.
Why?
Give people choice.
All right. But let me just say, I think, yes, Romney's going to have to explain his policies better than he did at the convention. I don't quarrel with that.
All right. Handicap, Biden v. Ryan.
That's going to be wild. You know,
I'm looking forward to that one.
Biden, even more so than a month ago. I mean, that guy is – he is free form, you know. So who knows what's going to come out.
But you know what? I mean – when I heard the Republicans say, oh, they're loving, they're ready to see Ryan mop the floor with Biden. I said, please. I mean, yeah, Biden is experienced, and he can say things off the wall and all that, but he's still likable. He deals with that. He knows his faults.
They're both likable, though.
Yeah, but he has facts on his side, too, and he'll be able to articulate facts. And certainly when it comes to dealing with foreign policy and things like that, I mean, I don't think Ryan stands a chance, and Ryan has to defend his own budget, which he still can't do.
But I would say I agree with you. I think Biden kind of wipes up with him on foreign policy. But I think Ryan could run circles around him on domestic issues because he can point to this. We got a $16 trillion debt, and I'm the one who's going to tell you about it, and we need to reform a program like Medicare, and here's how I would do it. What's your plan? You know what the administration has? Zero. It has no plan.
Well, their plan doesn't include a voucher system for Medicare,
which allows you to do traditional Medicare.
Well,
it's supported by a Democrat.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying. I mean, it's speaking to those seniors, speaking to those poor people, speaking to those people who are on the fence right now, destroying a program that is one of the most respected programs.
But I think Ryan, would be speaking to younger voters under 55, because that's the only person his plan applies to. I'm here to save this program for you. But having said, I think I look for Ryan to do a good job on economics, and you know, he better be boning up on the foreign policy front. Again, Biden, though, you know, just read some of his remarks and his extemporaneous comments and all these things. I'd be a little nervous if I were the Democrats having this guy go in there. As fun as he is, probably behind the scenes, you know.
I mean.
All right, quickly to poll numbers. It appears right now that the president is polling a bit ahead of Mitt Romney, but I went back and looked at your big election of 1980, Bill McKenzie, and into October, Jimmy Carter was leading Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean, and of course, the Iran crisis did weigh on Carter.
Yeah.
And Carter stayed in the White House, decided he wasn't going to campaign, which was a mistake. We know that now. But we can argue about whether or not, you know, the Reagan people were hoping that the Iranians kept the hostages, you know, up until Election Day, as they did, or actually to the inauguration day. But it seems to me that Romney has a lot to do to catch up now, particularly in the battleground states. I mean, the overall poll numbers, I think Gallup today is Obama leading by 7 overall. But you get to some of those battleground states, and I think Romney is losing. I mean, it's begun to—
More than not, right.
Yeah.
It is Obama's election to lose. If he's going to lose it, he's going to lose it through class warfare, and he's going to lose it more than that through the economy. And that's why I've said before, Romney just needs to keep drilling that home, laser-like focus, keep driving that issue home. That's his only chance.
You think Americans want class warfare, or do you think it's American politicians who want class warfare?
Well, that's a good one.
Politicians,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. More so than Americans. I mean,
but they know that may mobilize us somehow.
Oh, without a doubt.
Right.
I mean, it's both.
I think they're playing the audience.
All right. Well, I want you guys back in here if you can make it just a little bit before the election. We'll see how things have changed. Thank you both
so much
for being with us.
You're welcome.
Bill McKenzie is with the Dallas Morning News. Bob Ray Sanders writes for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can always learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.